Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Right. Good evening, everyone. And a big thank you for coming. Really do appreciate it. It's really nice to see so many faces, friendly faces. And it really means a lot to us, myself, Shane, Matthew, and Simon, for sharing this evening with us. I'm going to introduce you to Martin, who is my publisher and has helped me massively to get this, you know, this project underway over 12 years ago now, and it's still going. And without Martin, none of this would ever have happened. And Mr. Clayton would probably still be out there doing the things he always did. So anyway, I'll hand you over to Martin. Thank you.
Hi, good evening, everyone. I first met Paul, must have been 92 or 93. We were both runners for Collingwood Athletics Club. And I knows this guy. He was 29 going on 50 in terms of his attitude and his attitude to running and his attitude to everything. And I remembered that he was 29, and this will only mean something if you understand times for running. 10K is about 6.2 miles. That's quite a decent distance. Well, he was 29 and he ran a 10K, we're talking just over 6 miles, in under 30 minutes, in 29 minutes. I'd never seen anybody run, and especially for someone at my own club to be running. To be fair to myself, I ran 38, which was an elite time in those days. This guy ran 29. So that was the first time I noticed him because of his running. But he had there was a certain determination, a singularity about him. It was something different about him, and it wasn't just the running. Running is a lonely thing, and yet this is why running clubs are really good, because people who are solitary people, and most runners are solitary people, and I know that from being one as well. You have your own little world and little things going on in your life, and you would have never met so many different people at the same club, but the one thing that united us is that we all had our own little worlds. We all had our own little troubles, and I had troubles at the time, but it's not about me, it's about him. And Paul had his own little trouble. We kind of knew, we sort of pulled together as a running group, and for about 2 or 3 years we were really bonded world, and we never talked about our private lives. We talked about our running, our personal bests, and how well you run this, and oh yeah, I was really pleased with that. You coming out training, yeah, and it would be all that kind of thing. But underlying all of us was this other story, our own little stories that we carried around with us. And running saved my life, and I'm sure Paul will tell you it saved his too. Because you find something you can do really well. You didn't think there was something you could do, something you could excel at. And I suppose eventually there was going to be a time when I would find out more about Paul. I mean, occasionally I got a feeling that, you know, maybe he had troubles like me. I didn't realise quite what a life he'd led. Fast forward a few years, I met my partner Jules and moved in with her in Chiswick in the mid-90s. But I still ran a little bit for the club, but it was a long way away after that, and I left my teaching job. And but Paul and I kept in touch, but not so often. We went to football now and again. And then one day I received an email from him, and in this email he said, I've been writing some things down, and a mate of mine has written them up, and are in a PDF. If you'd just like to have a read of it sometime. So, because the other thing I didn't tell you that is that I had become a publisher and I had my own small publishing company, and Paul knew about that. So he sent me this, and I thought, I got a lot of things from people where people say, I've written a book sort of thing, and you, with all the best will in the world, you put it to one side. Anyway, fast forward 6 months. It's quite shocking, and I hold my hand up. It was 6 months, for I finally thought, I was telling him this just before we started today, it was a very bad edition of Match of the Day. West Ham must have lost, obviously, and probably, that's my team, of course, and probably a few others. And it was football, there's always something to enjoy, but on this particular one, it was desperate, and I thought, I suppose I better read this thing he sent me, because I thought that's it. Because he hadn't badgered me at all. And normally people go, have you read it? Have you read it? But I felt a bit guilty, because if he'd been keeping on at me every week, then you kind of think, oh, come on. But he hadn't. He hadn't got my back. So I thought, right, I'll read it. 11 o'clock, I turned the football off. I thought, I'll read a chapter. So I started reading it. And it's not even a comfortable read, because I haven't got, it's not like a nice little book like this. It's on my computer. And you know a computer, if you've ever used your computer in bed, it gets hot and it's awkward and you can't read the bloody thing. It wasn't on my phone, it was on my computer. Anyway, so everything was against me reading this, but I thought, I'll do it, let's read it. So anyway, started reading it. And I looked up and it's 5:30. I've been reading it I've virtually finished it. I was about a chapter before the end, and the time had gone like in the blink of an eye. If you've ever read a book that caught you, and I think a lot of you here will have done that, when a book, you might not even be a reader, but something in the book gets to you. It was partly the fact that I knew him, but much more than that, it was the compelling nature of the story. It just, if you haven't read it already, I strongly recommend you get it. This is the first one, and there's another one as well. You Can't Hurt Me. He'd already got the title for it as well. And I thought, we got to publish this. And it was still a bit raw, still needed a bit of editing, because any book you ever read is never the first draft. It's usually had lots and lots of people go through it. Everyone, even the top writers, have people who go through it and check things. This idea that any writer just writes something and it gets printed, absolutely not. There's a lot of hours go into this. So anyway, rather slightly guilt-ridden, I rang him on the Sunday. I said, yeah, this book of yours. I said, excuse my French, it's fucking amazing. I cannot believe it. I said, this is you, is it? I said, you're a dark horse. I said, all those times we went out running, you never talked about any of this. And then even as I was saying it, I realised that was a stupid thing to say, because it's obviously he wasn't going to have a conversation about this, but he put it down like you know that thing, if you've ever kept a diary, even if you've only kept it for a few days, you write honestly to your diary because you hope no one's ever going to read it. But he wanted someone to read this, and this was how it was going to be. Fast forward, here we are now. Two books, and I personally, for having been involved with them in any way, I'm really proud of these two. I mean, my company is quite a small company. We've only put out a handful of books, 11 or 12, but we only ever put out books that we really are convinced are something special. And these two books by Paul, I mean, I think, I don't even know, Paul will tell you whether he started out writing it with the aim of what he's achieved with it. I don't think he did. I think the reason all of us write, when we carry something around with us for years and years and years, is to unburden ourselves. And Paul had nobody to tell this story to, nobody in his life. So in the end, he told it to himself, which is what we do in a diary. And I was convinced that night I could see it already printed, and I didn't have my own printing. I didn't have my own publishing company then, But I worked with another person, and we had a slightly bigger operation, but we managed to get it out. And it was first printed in 2012. But Paul didn't want to publish it under his own name. He was a little bit conservative. There was no thought at all. You read it now and you think it's hard to believe. There was no thought at all that this book would be, as it says on this the second version of it, the book that helped convict a monster. That is no understatement. That is absolutely true. This book did it. And I am very humbled and, you know, can't really even find words to describe to you about having been connected with something that did such a powerful and important thing. And also the good that Paul has done the other victims of this man. But I think he'll tell you himself that that wasn't his goal originally, but then suddenly it starts to gather momentum. And as he'll tell you, because we got it published, somebody else read it, and then things started to take off. But it's an absolute and utter pleasure to have the chance to talk to you about a friend, and if I don't embarrass him too much, a hero of mine, really. He's been a great guy, Paul Stevens. Fantastic.
How'd you follow that line? A true gentleman. This man is a true gentleman, trust me. Anyway, let me just quickly say this. When I started writing my memoirs in 2007, I could never have known the impact it would have on my life and the path it has taken me down. I'm not going to sit here and tell you it's been easy, because it really hasn't. And the consequences of writing You Can't Hurt Me has taken me back down some very dark emotional roads and unlocked many inner demons that my subconscious locked away since Nigel Clayton took my innocence all those years ago. Once You Can't Hurt Me was released, it soon opened a can of worms that I could never have comprehended. And the revelations that came out changed my life forever. And one by one, answering many questions that I never knew I would ever find the answers to. Answers that you could never believe humans were capable of. After finding out why these people did those awful things to me when I was only a young child, and how they tried to wipe it under the carpet like it never happened, gave me the determination to discredit every single one of them. All of them had moulded me as a problem child from my earliest memories, and the lies they told to hide their crimes made my childhood a very unhappy existence, but also the strength to be the person I am today. Finding out these revelations and the pain it had caused me made me want to put the record straight. So whilst in lockdown in my home state of Victoria, Australia in 2020, I wrote Beyond the Hurt. As I wrote chapter after chapter, I questioned what I was actually writing was the truth. Many times the tears in my eyes splashed on the words as I was writing, because I was reliving every memory from that time of my life. Although hard to write, it is both true and honest, and it will show both sides of human nature. Many of you here today have known me and have known me for a long time. Know I have lived my life in the fast lane, hitting life full on, a ball in a china shop, never sitting still, just a few descriptions that many of you know me as. In 2015, an investigation into a man known as Nigel Clayton was opened because of a chapter I wrote in my first book. An investigation that would change my life, but also show why I had lived like a ball in a china shop. Not only did it derail my life, but it also impacted on many other men's lives. And here tonight are a few of those brave and courageous men who also want the world to know what impact Nigel Clayton had on their lives. Going through the ordeal of that horrendous trial back in 2021 will be etched in all of our minds. And I salute these brave men here tonight and the other victims of Clayton who went through that awful ordeal that Clayton's trial put us through. Your bravery is unfounded, and the truth has set you free. I know there's a few of Clayton's victims that are still in a dark place, and I hope you find peace one day. But just remember this. The pain we all went through and the bravery you showed will make sure Clayton never, ever inflicts any more pain and abuse on young boys again. With the help of these brave and lovely men and the help of the police who did believe us when so many didn't, Clayton will never have Clayton now will have the rest of his life to reflect on desire to abuse and destroy so many young children's lives within the four walls of his prison cell. Thank you. I'd like Matthew, Shane, and Simon, if you'd come up. Thank you.
All right, so I'm just going to say a few words real quick. So on the way here, my name is Sean, by the way, human rights activist, YouTuber. On the way here, I re-listened to the podcast that we did about 3 or 4 years ago now with Paul, and it just ripped my heart out from the get-go, where he's talking about, in the very beginning, he was only 18 months old, no dad, mum, the traumas are beginning, 18 months old? I've got a baby who is 14, 15 months old, a little person this big. How anything can be allowed to happen, it's just beyond comprehension. And it seems to me that the government doesn't give a shit because they don't prioritize these crimes. It takes the bravery of people like Paul speaking out and these guys speaking out to shine a light on this darkness for these people to be held to justice. Where were the cops for all these years while there was more and more victims? And one person that I interviewed, he said he went to get sentenced. He was expecting like a 9-year sentence. The judge got switched at the last minute, and it was the judge who was his abuser, and it gave him a life sentence. So we are campaigning for the justice system to start to value the lives of children and women who've been through these heinous crimes, because it seems the whole system is upside down. These predators get slaps on the wrist. I don't know if any of you have seen that documentary, The Sins of Our Father, the Catholic priest. They just moved him 20 miles here, 20 miles there, 20 miles. Hundreds of victims, some as young as babies. It just seems that the entire justice system is upside down. And we've learned a lot of this from the cops, ex-cops that we interviewed. They said they joined to go after the pedophiles, the rapists, the murderers. And it comes down from the top. They're told to do this other stuff. And they just don't achieve what they set out to achieve and put these monsters behind bars. All right, so guys, we're going to do one at a time. Is that? Okay. All right, so let's get you guys sat down here. And whoever's going to tell their story first, do you want to come and sit here? Because we've got to have that, got to have you speaking to the microphone. I know how hard it is as well. It's... No, Shane, like Shane. Okay. All right. So Shane is going to tell us a bit about what he went through and his journey. And Shane, you don't have to say anything that you're uncomfortable about. Just, you know, just whatever your heart is telling you to say right now, just go with that.
Where do I start?
Just start at the beginning. You know, what was your life like growing up?
McDonald's. Just say about your childhood. What do you remember? Fine. Oh, let's go. Let's try.
Take your time.
But I don't know where to begin.
Just talk about how it was for you growing up to begin with. just to let the people know what it's like for you.
It weren't the best, but...
Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in St. Eli Hospital. Oh, no. I become a mechanic, obviously working for Nigel. I was working for him for about 3 years. The first year, nothing happened. The second year, two things happened.
You're a brave man. Keep going.
And then it obviously we went to Guernsey, and then it happened again in Guernsey, twice. Ever since then I just can't focus straight and think straight, and I don't know really. It's just hard. Sentenced. I weightlifted off my shoulder, but obviously he's hurt me now, hasn't he? So yeah. He's got an easy way out, really. I don't know what to say.
We'll come back to you.
Yeah, let's take a break. Take a break. All right, so Simon's going to tell us some of his story next.
Hello, I'm Simon. Sorry, this is going to be really difficult for me. My anxiety is just through the roof at the moment. So I grew up on Roundshaw in Wallington from birth, 1976. Growing up, I absolutely loved growing up on Roundshaw. You just knew everybody.
Best playground. It was great.
You know, and I had loads of friends on Roundshaw. All I ever used to do when I was younger, I just wanted to play football. All I wanted to do was play football. And I met a friend who I'd known since I was about four. He's one of the victims as well. He's not here tonight. And unbeknown to me, he had a friend called Nigel. And I was outside on the decks with my football at 14 years of age, waiting to go and play football, and Nigel comes out, just starts talking to me, introducing himself. Hi, I'm Nigel. You know, well, what are you doing? What football team do you support? I support Arsenal. You know, and within about 2 minutes, who do you live at home with? I just live with my mum and my sister. Oh, no dad? No, I've never known my dad, I've never met him. Oh, that's sad. And it seemed from there, I don't know how it's happened, I don't know how. 1 minute it's there, and 2 weeks later I'm in an office and he's pulling my trousers down and doing things to me which I didn't want him to do. And it's taken me nearly 30 years, and that wasn't just it, it went from 1990 to 1995. It took me having to go to Young Offenders to get away from him. I turned to drugs, smoking cannabis all the time. I couldn't drink, I didn't like drinking, but I turned to drugs. And then one day in 2015, I was with my partner, and we were just driving past the BP garage in Carshalton, and who do I see after all these years? Nigel, happy, bouncing off to the shop. And I've never said anything to anybody. I kept it inside. Because I just blamed myself for all the that you've done, taking pictures and videos. Looking at these cameras is so difficult because I'm worried about them. But and seeing them, and I just blurted it out. It's like I just wanted to come out, and I just said, "See him? Yeah. He abused me when I was young." And then I said, "Please don't say nothing." And my partner, obviously being my partner, decided to call the police, and it just went from there. And yeah, it's very difficult. I didn't know whether to give a statements or anything like that. And I was told about a guy, couldn't tell me names or anything. The police officer said, "Look, there's an older gentleman, he's a boxer, and it's happened to him. And if he can do it, then you can do it." And yeah, then I realised that I wasn't the only one. I wasn't the only one. I thought I was the only one that he was doing it to. And I find out Mark, who I've known since I was 4 years of age, was being abused by him for over 30 years, and it was still going on. And the way that he tried to get Nigel to stop abusing him was by putting Nigel on me. And a friend that I've known since I was little basically put a pedophile on me and so that he didn't get abused himself. And yeah, I'd never forgive him for that. I'm happy now. I met Paul, Shane. I'm so proud of Shane. He's the youngest, and I blame myself that if I hadn't reported it in the 90s, it wouldn't have happened to these two. And people say no, it probably still would.
It was reported.
No.
It was reported for 40 years.
I don't know what else to say now. But yeah, and we're here now, and I'm so proud of Paul. He's like, I've never had an older brother, but he's been a rock since I met him. And yeah, if it wasn't for Paul. Yeah, it'd be difficult.
Well done. Well done. I mean, so many survivors, they just hold it in and they bury it and they're too afraid to talk about it. And it's only a small percent who have the bravery of these guys here today to come out and speak about these things, these raw emotions that are coming out right now. And Matthew, ready?
Thank you. Hi everyone. I've actually written some notes down on my phone, so I can assure you I'm not texting. I'm just reading from it. So I wanted to be able to read this out in court, but the experience of being stood in front of Nigel Clayton and the whole experience of being in court was extremely traumatic. At the time, I wasn't able to do so, but now, after some reflections and working after my life, I feel in a better place to be able to say what this man has done to my life. And I do hope one day he watches this recording back and think about how his selfish actions have impacted every single one of us. At the time of the abuse started, I felt embarrassed, dirty, and disgusting. I felt like, why did this happen to me? The way he groomed me, the way he chose what I wore, what I'd done, where I was allowed to go, and who I was allowed to see. I sometimes wish I could look back at my younger self and say, what were you doing? Why are you allowing this to happen to you? I wish I knew what I knew today. The way this man has impacted my life because of him, I now suffer with PTSD and anxiety. Life has been difficult and every day is a challenge. Just to do the basic things like get out of bed, every day is a fight and something I know I will have to live with for the rest of my life, but something I know one day will make me stronger. The court case was difficult. It was difficult to be hidden away in the room as his defense was saying we all knew each other and it was all a conspiracy to get his money. I would like to say I don't want a penny of this man's money. For me, it would be dirty money. He can keep his money as there's no point being the richest person in the graveyard. And that really was not the case. Although it's hard knowing what happened to other people in the same way, it was also comforting to know that there were people out there that felt the way I felt. To be stood in court, look into his defense eyes and being called a liar, and then to question how someone could defend someone like him, as it's not something I would ever be able to do for no amount of money. Stood up in court was kind of a daze now, as what I remember was looking at this digital clock and holding this plastic cup of water, trying not to shake, as I stood there and relived everything all over again, knowing he was in the same room as me. It was terrifying. But I know I had to be there to stop this man doing it to anybody else. If I can take something positive away from this, I will never see myself as a victim, but rather a survivor. Yes. Because of him, I'm because of him I'm a fighter. Thanks to all the things he done to me and the other people, he has made me stronger. Therefore, if my story can just help one single person, that's enough for me. Therefore, Nigel, if you ever watch this, I am no longer that scared little boy you remember, and I will continue to push myself, and I know I can do anything if I put my mind to it. This will be my legacy, but what will yours be, Nigel? Thank you.
Well done. Well done. Thank you. Thank you. Awesome. All right, so we're going to open it up to questions from you guys. So while you guys are thinking of questions, I'll start out asking a question first. So we'll get to you guys shortly. So, like, you know, Paul's got the running and the fitness that keeps his head straight. What do you guys do? Do you guys have something that keeps you focused and keeps you going?
My little man. My newborn keeps me going.
Yeah. How old is your newborn?
She's having contractions. He's due soon.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations.
Also, mine's my children. I've got two older children, two younger children. They're my life, and I'll do anything to keep them safe.
I think it would be from my family. They've been really supportive. And my nieces and nephews as well. They kept me going.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, guys. All right, who would like to be the first person to ask a question? Has anyone got anything? Yes, at the back.
Was he married? And if he was, do you think his wife was?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was married. But in court, he said to his defence that he was a happily married, heterosexual man with a wife, a daughter and a granddaughter. Because of a certain victim, his wife basically told, she was in on, even though she said she didn't know, she knew what he was doing. She said that, and I remember it to the day I die, her statement read, my name is Clayton. I've been married to Nigel Clayton for 50 years. It wasn't the happiest of marriages, but I took my wedding vow seriously. She then went on to say that Nigel says he's a happily married heterosexual man with a daughter and a granddaughter. The daughter wasn't his, it was from a previous relationship. She then said, we haven't shared a marital bed since 1977. I won't say the guy's name, but the victim said that he had moved in with Clayton into his marital home. And this victim said that he had lived him for over a year and slept in his bed most nights. The wife was basically 6 foot away in another room. She then said that she tried to help him, but he was a very angry young man. But then she said, but she wasn't surprised because he shared the bed with Nigel Clayton for over a year. And then she said that, but she was unaware of anything really going on. So yeah, he was married, but you know, did she know? We think she did. When he was convicted, and found guilty, we went back to prison, waiting for sentencing. Within 3 weeks of him going back to prison, he had signed all his assets over to her, and she lived on this manor. She then sold everything and moved, disappeared. So there's your answer right there, yeah.
All right, next question, please. Has anybody got anything? Yes, at the back.
Do you feel
I'll go across the guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. What Paul's done, and I've worked with survivors in the UK as well, and if we can just help one person, it's a cliche, but you know, if one man and it's happening to them, or a boy, and they can report it, then they will be believed. So yeah.
Yeah, just the sort of same as everybody else, really. Yeah, it's, you know, if it helps just one single person, then, you know, for us it's done, right? So, yeah.
Exactly.
Since Clayton's been locked away, many other victims have come forward. We don't know exactly how many, but we do know there's a few that he's under investigation for them as we speak. So yes, if we hadn't have come forward, then yeah, he would still be out there doing it. I'm convinced of that now. So yeah, it has helped, of course, massively, you know, and it's helped closure for us all. So yeah, it had to come out. It had to.
Yeah, well done.
So whenever we put a podcast out, when we've interviewed a survivor, we always get people emailing us saying, I listened to this story and it's inspired me to come forward and, you know, tell people what I went through. And in Paul's case, we got this email in October 2024. Hey Sean, I've just been listening to your podcast about Paul and his brother Nigel Clayton. My brother alerted me to your podcast. I believe I was one of Clayton's first victims. Unfortunately, I don't remember Paul or Alison, but I lived in the same block as Clayton, number 14, Mellor Close, and attended the primary school next to the flats, Beddington Park Farm. I moved there with my mother and two older siblings around the beginning of the 70s, when I was around 12 or 13. I remember Clayton's Land Rover Jeep, his huge dogs. I played on the meadow in front of the flats, along the River Wandle, and the woods at the end. I lived in Croatia. Well, I live in Croatia, and I was there earlier this year to visit the area and to check on the large cedar tree that the kids back then kept trying to burn down. You weren't one of them,
yeah, I was.
Paul will confirm my details. The nearby estate was Crispin Crescent. I am at least fortunate in that Clayton did not do much to me, but Paul's recollection of wrestling resonated. Clayton would pin me down, sit backwards astride, and fiddle with my flies a bit. I recall this happening twice at least. I found his actions annoying, but I would still hang out with him. I also went to the house in Manor Road, which I believe his father owned, where Clayton went to pick up some rent. Fortunately, I am not troubled by my encounter. I am not a victim. I found by chance a newspaper article a year or so ago about him and his conviction and a request for any further information. I contacted the police and have given them my statement on two occasions, along with supporting photographs. I am waiting to hear the outcome. Please pass on my best wishes to Paul. It was so brave of him to tell his story. Kind regards, Andrew. Let's give Andrew a round of applause for the watch. All right, so I'll ask another question, and if you guys have got more questions, I'll get back to you shortly. So with Clayton getting away with this for 40 plus years, what are your thoughts on how he was able to achieve that and the role of the authorities letting him fall through the cracks?
I don't know what you mean.
All right, so I'm asking, what are your thoughts on him getting away with it for so long?
I've not thought about it yet.
No. You haven't thought about it?
No.
Okay,
I've got it out of my head.
I have to say, he was very clever. I'm a friend of Matt's, and he knew that I worked at Poland. I was a tour guide at the time. And he automatically befriended me, talking about Tom Brake, the local MP, and the fact that he lived upstairs. And he was very good at the grooming. So any of the victims were automatically in that thing where there was that fear of authority. So it's no one's fault, but I think that the fact that he was in with the authorities made it even harder for you guys. So even brave that you did that thing. So just so you know.
Yeah.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Everybody that knew Clayton will tell you what a calm man he was. Some lovely ladies here that actually still live in Mellor Close now. Who are now going through hell because Clayton had a company, basically took it upon himself to have a maintenance company to maintain the block of flats where these ladies live and where a few of the other people did live. He was taking out from the 70s, he was taking money every month, as you do when you have these flats, you pay into a fund every month for the maintenance. Now, unfortunately, these lovely ladies, unfortunately, and this gentleman here, are having to pay vast amounts of money to get these flats back up to scratch because they were unaware of what Clayton was doing. Only when he went to prison, they still didn't know that he'd gone to prison. They were just told he was ill or other reasons. So yes, a con man to the wildest imagination you can ever. He tricked everybody. Amy will tell you that he worked in the restaurant right around the corner from the stable yard where he abused a few of these victims. And he would come in, he was an absolute gentleman. Everyone in the area knew him. They never had a clue. I'd say probably this lady here, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, but she is the only person that's actually said to me, I knew him for 20 years and I never liked him. There was something about him. But everybody else, I say they're paying hundreds of thousands of pounds now to get these buildings back up to scratch because he was a con man. So yeah, he conned everybody and not just abusing us, but the way he controlled. He didn't control me because it was a long time ago for me and I never ever saw him again. But some of these other victims, God bless them, he controlled them. And I mean controlled, and one guy he controlled for 30 plus years. And I mean controlled with an iron fist. And even when he got arrested, he blamed this other person who turned turned Queen's evidence against him, because if he hadn't, he would have gone to prison and Clayton would have let him. So this is the sort of person we're dealing with. And more people now are coming forward, and I think this is only the beginning. This is going to keep going and going and going. We're never going to be free of him. He's always going to be in our heads. We just have to learn to live with it, and that's the truth.
Yeah, it's a reoccurring theme with these predators that they can manipulate the system. And in the case of one Saville survivor that we interviewed, we found out that Saville, wherever someone reported him across the country, that report had to go to Leeds Police, and he had a weekly luncheon for Leeds Police, and the guy that handled all the incoming reports was one of the attendees at his lunch club. So all those reports, as they came in over the decades, just got trashed. And this is one of the strategies these monsters employ to get away with things for so long. All right, so can we take the next question then, please? Has anybody got anything? Yes?
My mum didn't like him either. She thought he was a wrong one as well. So
I don't think my mum ever met him, as far as I can remember, but mum was donkeys years ago, so she's on dementia, and so I think I have as well.
I suppose I don't really need to answer because you kind of answered it for me, so thank you.
Answer that part.
You read my first book, you will read how it came about that my mum actually found out about it. But it was all, my mum never believed it. She didn't believe anything, to be truthful. So yeah, she knew, my social worker knew. It's all in the book, you read it and then you'll understand that, the police were informed. Back in the 70s, they did nothing. They wasn't interested, and that was the truth. So it's different now. They have to, by law, they have to investigate things. But back in the 70s, you know, we all knew, didn't we? But the older people that are here tonight, you know, everyone, you know, their mum would say, oh, keep away from him, he's a dirty old man. Do you know what I mean? It's just how it was in them days. Nowadays, it would be completely different. So, yeah, she did know, but she chose not to, so.
Yeah, the Savile survivor we interviewed, she was at Duncroft Girls' School, and Savile preyed on people in care homes, where they would, he called them his sweet shops, where they wouldn't have parents that they could go to report these things. And that was another strategy that we see over and over again with these predators, going after kids in the care homes. So there's no parental figures that can intervene and stop this. Yeah. All right, next question, please. Has anyone else got anything? Yes? Good question. Any counselling or anything?
No, I didn't get offered them. No. Obviously, I would like to have gone, but I didn't get offered them.
It's never too late.
I know.
Yeah, so I've had 16 counselling sessions with Survivors UK, 18 counselling sessions with the local authorities and mental health team. I take antidepressants, I take anti-anxiety tablets, all because of what Nigel did.
Yeah, I was offered support, but, you know, the NHS, it took so long. I think I was on a waiting list for a year just to, after the court case. So, you know, your black brain plays tricks on you in that whole year time, right? Because really you need it there and then, straight after the court, while it's fresh. But it was such a long time. So, yeah, you kind of learn to deal with it yourself.
Yeah, in my case, I never believed in counselling. I didn't believe it. I was just, as I said in when I read at the beginning, I'm a boy in a child's job. I just had head on in everything, and I thought, no, I don't need counselling. I really didn't think I needed it. But to tell the truth, when the investigation into Clayton started, I can't sit here and lie. I broke down. I'd locked it away for so many years. So then the first investigating officer said to me one day, you know, Paul, you're not doing good. You really need to go and see someone. And I actually agreed. I thought, well, I can't live like this, because I weren't sleeping. I didn't sleep much anyway, but I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. You know, I'd cry all the time. Yeah, it was terrible. But Survivors UK, and this is another reason why I'm doing this, I did ask for a representative for them to come tonight, but for some reason, they're probably too busy, they couldn't come. But every penny, not every penny, but some of the money I make from this books, if we make any, because we've never made a penny from it so far, but we now, we can release them in our own names because the police took them off the shelves because of the investigation to Clayton. I couldn't put the book out there, and it was doing okay. So, but now the reason that I am going to write a third book, and it's going to be a book about all these victims and their life story, not just about what Clayton did to them, but about their growing up, everything that happened to them, their earliest memories, everything that I wrote about in my book, they've asked me to write for them. So I'm going to write a third book. And every penny from that book, I'm going to donate to Survivors UK, because believe me, these two lovely fellas here, they need Survivors UK, and they haven't got it. So, and I can honestly say, I used to look forward to my counselling. On a Monday morning, I'd go all the way to Shadwell, I'd jump on a train, took me an hour and a half to get there, and I can honestly say, unless you've been through this, God bless them, I used to leave an hour and a half counselling with my counsellor, and I would fall asleep on the train. It used to absolutely emotionally wipe me out, and I have got more energy than anybody. That's you know, what they do is massive. It helped me massively, and I feel I've overcome so much. Listen, we still got a few, you know, I'm still quite fiery and blah blah blah. But without them, God knows where I'd be, and that's the truth. So I am going to make sure that Shane definitely and Matthew get the help that they need. That's why we're doing this, that's the truth.
All right, who's got another question, please? Anyone over there, yes? So what advice would you give to another victim that's scared to come forward?
Try to come forward. Try build it up to come forward, come out of it.
I know how difficult it is because it took me nearly 30 years, but it will happen, and there's people out there that will listen to you, and the police will investigate any allegations. So, just please say something.
Yeah, I agree. It never goes away, right? It's just something you learn to deal with all the time. And speaking up really does help. It really does make a difference, because although it's still there at the back of your mind, when you say it out loud and you're believed, it's like a weight lifted off your shoulders.
Yeah, definitely, Matthew. That's the truth, you know. And if you're honest with yourself as a victim of this, it's the humiliation, number one. You feel so humiliated, you feel dirty, you feel this, you just don't like yourself to even talk about it. But more than that, it's hard to explain, really, unless you've actually, like these fellas, you know, they live with it every day of their lives, it never ever leaves you. But yeah, definitely, you know, just come forward and make that jump. You have faith now because they do believe you, because if they hadn't, we wouldn't be here today. So no, you must come forward and, you know, just have the nuts to do it.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to say that knowing Paul and having a four-year-old ourselves, I've read both books, and it was like a challenge between being compelling but really uncomfortable as well. And actually Paul was telling me, no, keep reading, you know, you've got to keep reading it. Have you guys been able to read his books, or is it too close to home? And how did you feel if you have read them? How did it make you feel?
So have you read the books or something? You've not read it. Have you guys?
I've read about three chapters, but it's really difficult. And I'm only just now starting to be able to watch stuff on YouTube and the Jimmy Savile stuff, and also the footballers that came out years ago. They were putting it in my mind, actually, when they came out. That's where I seemed to get it started to play in my mind as well.
I think it helped for me because although it's unfortunate how we've all met, it's also very comforting as well, knowing that you're not on your own. So I found the book, I mean, I couldn't put it down, I read it in one night. I found it very helpful.
I'd just like to ask Paul then, have people who've read your book, have they been inspired to contact you?
There's one of, unfortunately I don't do social media, I don't do Facebook, I don't do any of that, so to get hold of me is quite difficult, but there have been a few that have contacted me, you know, and I don't, honestly, when the trial was over and he was convicted, you know, everyone was saying, you know, oh, it's amazing. I don't see myself as a hero, I really don't. I'm just really, honestly, I don't think these do either. These fellas don't do. We're not heroes. We just, you know, we had to do it. You know, it wasn't, you know, it's not something we wanted to do, and it was the most horrendous, awful thing, wasn't it? It was this, you know, absolutely the worst time of my life. So no, I don't see myself as a hero. Definitely not. But it's something that had to be said, and he had to be put away, and he has. So yeah, you know, and it's because of these guys. Truthfully, I wrote it. And then that's when the police asked me who the person in my book was. This is how it all started. They was investigating the disappearance of a local lad, and they asked me who they'd interviewed 2,000 known people over 13 years, and they still were no nearer to finding this young lad. And they asked me if I could give him a name. It's all in the book. You'll be amazed. Can I be honest? It was karma. It was meant to happen because I hadn't seen him for 30 odd years. And then all of a sudden I write this book, which has opened, you know, caused all the, you know, it was a lot of heartache for us, all of us, not just me. And then it was karma. 3 weeks later, I stumbled across this guy and it was just like it was meant to happen. So yeah, and then the rest is history. The book was taken off the shelves. You Can't Hurt Me, he disappeared for 5 years. It's only now that we can publish it in our own name.
because yeah, it's strange how it all happened, and it, but like all of us, it's not just me. These guys are the heroes. Not, honestly, I don't see myself as a hero, and I know they don't, but they truly are, because what happened to them was far worse than what happened to me.
Any more questions, please? Anyone got anything? Yes. Anybody else got any questions? And if they want to get the books, Paul, what's going to be the procedure?
Well, there's books at the back there, so okay. If you want a book, I'll sign it for you. And what I'm going to do very, very quickly, because I don't know what the time is, but anyway, I'm going to read a little bit of three chapters, just of the new book. Just so you can gauge what the book's about. But trust me, what I wrote in the first book was never going to be a book. It was just memoirs for me to deal with something that was basically my son went and left and went to America, and it broke my heart because he was everything to me. So when he disappeared to America, I was just left, and it's like my right arm had fell off. I didn't know what to do. So I wrote memoirs. And that's what that was. It wasn't meant to be a book. It's just a friend of mine read it and went, "You've got to get this published." Martin then came in, and the rest is history. If we hadn't written memoirs, Clayton would still be out there doing it now. So the second book is about everything I found out from the first book, which, to be honest with you, I wasn't ready for. And then when I started to I discovered all these things, I was horrified. Absolutely, I could not. But at the same time, it answered questions for me, and I was just like, now I understand why these things happened. I would never have got them answered had I never ever wrote that book. I personally think the second book is the first book's very angry when I wrote it, and you'll see that there's a lot of swearing in it, and I'm sorry about that, I apologize, but the second book is a lot calmer and a lot more, I understand a lot more. You'll get the gauge of it. So yeah, they're at the back there. I'll sign them for you. And Martin knows, I can't even tell you how much they are, but obviously we've had to fork out to get them printed, so there will be a cost. But and a part of that money that we get for these books, and Amy's done amazing. I can't thank Amy enough. She has pushed and pushed and pushed these, and she's going to keep pushing it, and we will get them out there, and they will be successful, and we will raise money for survivors. Because survivors run off of donations, they're not government funded, and it costs so much money for these people to help people like us. So that's what we're trying to do. So, but I will read it, just a couple, probably take 10 minutes, and it'll give you an insert. It's not just about, these books are not just about Clayton. Clayton was only a very small part of one chapter which started all this. So the rest of the books are just, it's about everything. So it's very interesting. You'll enjoy them, I'm sure you will. So I will read a little bit for you, and then that'll be it, I think.
Okay, and all the fellas have said that if anyone wants to ask them a question in private as well, when Paul's finished reading, they'll be up here and they'll be available to speak to anyone, whatever you've got. So.
Right, I'll just start with what I wrote, what was in the first book. And I just wrote this, to call myself a writer. I know there's a book out there with my name on it. It's something I could never have imagined earlier in my life. If someone had told me that I would have a book published, I would have laughed at them. As a child, just getting through every day was tough enough for me. The obstacles and minefields I had to negotiate made learning at school something of a non-starter. Listening and taking in what was happening all around you still happened to me, but not inside the four walls of any school I might have to spend the odd few hours in on my way up to adulthood. Early on, my young life was just a screenshot of lies and deceit perpetrated by those who were supposed to be in the role of caring for me.
My mother, stepfather and social worker were inept in every conceivable manner. For me, out of sight was truly out of mind. I was branded trouble at school, a problem child, as they used to call us. My class position was at the back with all the other problem children. Sport became my thing and I excelled at it. Anything from football, running, cricket and boxing, I would never spell my way to the top, but I could run. And by the time I was 12, there were few who could even compete with my speed, let alone beat me. I was one of the top youth runners in the south of England. When my mother told me I was useless, she was actually issuing me with a challenge. I won county and inter-county honours. I even ran for a young England squad twice in the south of France, finishing in the top three in both races. My movement towards the hallowed status of writer took another turn when I became a father at 21, far too young, but I soon became dedicated to my son, who went to achieve a top level in sport and business. We shared all the wonderful experiences that life could throw at us. Our memories together soon began the healing for what had I experienced as a boy when I was his age. I began writing in 2007 when my son moved to the USA to pursue his motocross career and focus on my memoirs to help me with my loss. This became my first book, You Can't Hurt Me. I still struggle with spelling, but my iPhone has been a great help to me in this area, as anyone who has one will understand. I write how I talk from my heart, allowing my life experiences to mold my style. I've had the help of putting my book together from a friend I met at my running club back in the 90s, who has helped me get my book published. As you will find out if you get the chance to read my story, probably the best thing about all this is my recollections and revelations about the abuse I suffered at the hands of a serial child abuser. Meant in May 21, this man was found guilty of 31 offences against other victims just like me, and is now in Belmarsh Prison, where he has spent the rest of his years, no longer a threat to children. I'm not going to read the old chapters, so honestly, I'll just read a little bit of each of three. April 1969, I bang on the front door on the 13th floor of the concrete tower block that was my home. Too young at 30 months to remember, but I now sat listening to my aunt tell me the story about yet another party in my 18-year-old mother's flat. Populated by a herd of undesirable drunk young people that all lived in this concrete metropolis. The party was in full swing and the flat was heaving with people drinking and dancing to the psychedelic music from the end of a great music era, most unaware that just a few feet above them, their stoned heads were two young children upstairs asleep. Bang, bang, bang on the door, but the music was too loud for any of the party goers inside to hear. Bobby's Girl by Marcia Blaine was blaring across the kitchen and the front room of the flat, drowning everything else out. When the song eventually finished and someone went across to put the next record on, the sound of the banging finally got through. One of the drunk guests stumbled down the hall and opened the door. The three police officers had been trying to gain attention of the drunken horde inside the smoke-filled flat, peered in disbelief. The first officer pushed the drunken yob to one side. And heading towards the record player, the scorch of the source of the disturbance terminated the sound of a needle torn across the surface of the next disc before contact could be effectively made. Everybody stay exactly where you are, the party's over, the second officer yelled. The third officer stood guard by the now closed front door. Whose flat is this? The first officer snapped. An attractive petite brunette made her way to the smoke-filled haze from the kitchen into the front room where the other policemen were waiting. It's my flat, the young woman said, her words slurred. In her mouth she was smiling. Disarming smell of hung in the air. The many elements of this sauce stubbed out in the green ashtrays on the side table. Once the evidence of drugs had been established, people were searched and a small number of men were arrested for possession. The others were dismissed, and the two officers went upstairs looking for more evidence of partygoers attempting to avoid being caught. They found no other partygoers there, but came across two small children, a boy and a girl, cuddled each other, huddled in the small corner of a bed in a cold, unkept room that stank of urine and adult discretion. As the children awoke in the fear of the sudden disturbance and the uniformed man, their mother was called to comfort them. An hour or so, the children were asleep with just their mother in the flat. The police and the remaining guests had left in the dead of night, and the senior officer was already at his desk writing a report to discover the discovery of two abandoned young children in a flat in South London. Now there's a few people here who know of a lovely, lovely young lad called Lewis Pinto, and a very, very lovely boy. So I'm just going to read you a little. It's quite a heart-rending chapter. It's about his life, but I'll just read you a little bit of it. September the 6th, 1992. That was the day I held my little boy's hand as he walked past the school gate on for his very first time towards the entrance of St. Elphrege's Roman Catholic Primary School. The happy sound of children running around the playground, all full of excitement and anticipation after a long hot summer holiday. It was all I could hear, and I bathed in the sound, longing momentarily for the innocence that seems at the heart of such a sound. Everyone knows this sound. Everybody can remember the feeling of the sweet innocence, even if it's sometimes to be short-lived. There's nothing like it. St. Elphrege's seemed to be a happy school, and as Joseph squeezed my hand a little tighter, I knelt down to his height and gave him a cuddle and squeezed him back. "Don't worry, mate," I whispered to him. "Everything will be fine," as I kissed him goodbye. His mother took his hand and walked off towards his classroom. The children looked a little shy and apprehensive as one by one they took their first steps to a new chapter in their young lives. It was at that moment I noticed the little boy still out in the playground. Something of a solitary pose reminded me. Sorry. Of myself at that age. He seemed very confident and even had a spring in his step, different from the rest, a real little charmer, Lewis Pinto. A beautiful boy, a boy who would be loved and by everybody who knew him. As the primary school years went by, Joseph made friends with most of the boys in his year group, and Lewis Pinto was one of the loveliest. I went to every school sports day to cheer Joseph and his friends on, and I would never miss any of his football matches. I would cheer the team from the sidelines each time I went, and began to notice more and more the similarities between the 9-year-old Lewis Pinto and myself at the same age. Lewis was one of the most loving little boys you could ever wish to meet, with a caring nature beyond his years. Even so, there was a fire in his belly, and if things didn't go his way, and sometimes it did, especially on a football field, he would explode in rage of uncontrollable frustration. And I often found myself at such times calming him down with words of encouragement. That is an amazing chapter, so it is sad, but read on. And I'm just going to read you just a little bit of this one. This is the last chapter in the book, and it's called Finally. It's a date I'd waited for 6 long years. I woke at 3 a.m. as I had done since I'd been a child. As Amy will tell you, I was always the first to wake, the best security there is to start the day. Opening this particular can of worms hadn't changed my sleep patterns one bit. In truth, I'd never slept soundly. I didn't know what it would be like. Horrific dreams about Clayton over many years had put pay to that. Would I find out one day? I tried on combinations of 4 different suits, shirts, ties and shoes over the next hour. There was no way I would let the judge and jury see me as a South Londoner Herbert, or Herbert as we say, that the defence would try to present as me as during this trial. First impressions count, That was one thing I had learned in my life over the years. I hadn't been born with a silver spoon in my mouth, but I was born, and I still had my pride, even if Clayton had tried to destroy that as well. He had given me and all the other victims I was about to meet in court a life sentence as a result of the sentence he had subjected all us to. I took my first steps out the front door and took a deep breath as I began the walk to Croydon Crown Court with a determination to claim back the part of my life that had been stolen from me. As I walked the 4 miles or so to court along the narrow pathways next to the picturesque River Wandle that had flown along the same route all the time I was on this earth, memories returned of catching bright red sticklebacks and putting them in an old coffee jar with a few newts that I'd caught an hour earlier, then tying together a few wooden pallets to create a makeshift raft. I would float down the Wandle in full flood. It seemed like the Grand Canyon as when we were kids, as it dropped over the edge of the waterfalls, keeping our balance as the raft adjusted, if it still held together. Then we would come to Crewe Manor, where we stopped as the river ran too high to go under the 500-year-old bridge. So we would jump off the raft and pull it from the other side if it got through. Next, a rope swing, as Alison knows. A focal point for many a young boy and girl playing in the park at the weekend. A simple wooden plank tied up to the upper branches of a few creative adults from the council estate. Hours of pleasure from simple thoughtfulness. Not all adults were like Clayton, thank God. We would meet there and try to be the best at jumping off the tree 15 feet above the river, clinging onto one another with the ropes, with knots to break our fall. Swinging across the river, we felt like Tarzan, the king of the jungle. They were all my happy memories, culled from a troubled childhood before Clayton turned my life upside down. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, sir. All right, so the fellows are going to be available if anyone wants to ask them questions in private now. And I think, is Martin going to man the books table for people if they want to get books?
Yeah, I'll go and sign them.
And Paul will be available to sign them. But let's just give everyone, Martin, Paul, Shane, Simon, Matthew, a huge round of applause, thank you.
Can I, before we finish, I'd just like to say a few thank yous. It's important for me to do this. First and foremost, I'd like to thank this wonderful place for allowing us to use their facility. It really is very kind of them. And they've been really, really, really kind. So thank you to the Grange. And if anybody wants to come for a lovely meal, this place really is an amazing place. Lovely, lovely people.
Just for us to remind them about the car regs.
And by the way, if you haven't put your car registration in, please do. But because unfortunately, it's not the Grange; it's a private company. But anyway, yes, they're amazing. So thank you to them. Just a few thank yous. I'd firstly like to thank Martin. Where's he gone? There he is, over there. Martin Godwin. Without Martin and his belief in my book, we would not be here today, and these brave men would not have the closure they deserve or the closure that they're going to get, trust me. Thank you, Martin, for your hard work over the years, for the endless hours you have given up for the truth to be told. Thank you. To Sean Atwood, who's sitting next to me. Sean, you brought this story to the world with your amazing podcasts. The way you calmly interview and treat your guests shows how much you truly care about our emotions whilst reliving some of the worst times of our lives. Your podcast has touched and helped so many people with your desire to tell the truth. Thank you so much.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
To all my friends here tonight, and you are all my friends, you have all shared this journey with me, every single one of you. You have helped me more than you could ever know. And that's the truth. I have shared many ups and downs with you all, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart. And to my beautiful Amy. And my little Noah, please. God bless him. Amy, without your support tonight, would never have happened. It wouldn't have been possible. You have become my best friend. You've also become friends with Simon, Matthew and Shane since the trial of Clayton. And you have shared our friendship with all of them. Amy has supported me through these very trying few years, and I need to thank her for loving me the way she does. She's the kindest soul and always puts everybody first. Thank you for your love and devotion. And my little Noah's gone home, bless him. I was just going to thank you for being the best stepson I could have ever wished for. And the message he sent me last night for my birthday, he's just unbelievable. He's truly a beautiful little thing. So thank you, Amy, for letting me share him with you. Anyway, that's it. Thank you ever so much for coming.
All right, so thank you, everybody. So the books are in the corner. Like I said, if you've got any questions you want to ask the guys in private, just come and up here and we'll be up here. Cheers.
And it's my birthday, so I'm going to go downstairs and have a couple of beers. So please come and join us.
Thanks.
Well done.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. livewithchampion.com.